Welcome to Before They Were Live, ongoing monthly, extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy or the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says he has hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder, but not of information. We take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art, criticism, fandom, paying attention to the way stories have shaped our collective imaginations. We are slurpers of soup, happy to ladle out a bowl full from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden said, art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead. So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl, a big old chunk of homemade bread, and help us enrich this reading experience and have some fun too. This is our sixth foray into the world of the Arabian Nights. Today we will be discussing the stories from nights 146 to 169. Helping me, as always, to tell and make sense of these tales. If chivalry were lost, you can be sure that it is only with him that it would be found. If I had a secret which I was afraid to make known, it is in his heart that it would be hidden. It's Dr. Michael Farmer.
Josh, I want you to know that we're not actually friends, and I only do what you say because you are cruel to me.
Gained by their intelligence, and not all fools suffer for their foolishness. So,
yeah, fair enough. How you doing?
It's a big change of pace today on our stories. So, when we initially were talking about, what should we do next after? What do we do before this?
Kipling.
Kipling right before this, right? And I thought that maybe the Arabian Nights would be a little more along the lines of Grimm's, something along those lines. And boy, was I wrong, not knowing anything. But today we are closer to it than ever. And in fact, one of these stories is very, very similar to a Grimm's. So it'll be interesting to compare and contrast, I guess.
I think that the truth about the Arabian Nights is it's like almost everything because it contains so many different sorts of stories. So, I mean, there is stuff that's like the Grimm's. There's stuff that's the stuff we read today is some of it. I guess it's not that similar to Kipling because it's not the Just So stories, but it's similar to Aesop. It's similar to there's all sorts of stuff in the Arabian Nights. I think what we learned is the multiplicity of this collection.
Yes, for sure. And actually, I did think that the one story that's pretty early on. Is it the first one that we talk about? Yeah. Yeah, it is the first one. The one with the son of Adam. I did feel like it was a little bit Kiplingish. Not quite.
But, right, right.
You know, like there was, you know, you could tell like, oh, maybe Kipling was drawing upon some of this stuff, you know?
The role of human beings in that story is similar to Kipling. But what you don't get is, here's why leopards have spots.
Right. Right. Except, anyway, we'll get there. Except for one place where maybe it's explaining why pigeons are everywhere. I'm not quite sure what the point of that story was.
That was a weird story.
It may be that, though. That may be the point of it. So,
Before we get started talking about them, the stories we read for today, other than the very last one, are supposedly the oldest stories in the Arabian Nights, and I think for the most part, they're not Arabian. I think they're coming from India. You know, it's kind of like Proverbs, the book of Proverbs. There's stuff from all over. It's not like one person is inventing all of this stuff. It's collecting whatever stories they can find. And I forget where I read this, so I wouldn't swear by it. But I think what I read is all these animal fables are much older than the other stories, and they don't come from Arabia, which makes sense. Right. I mean, there's some references to God, but there's not a lot of references to Islam.
Yeah. And actually, so I was going to ask you about that because you mentioned Aesop earlier. One of these stories I was telling my kids about, and they're like, that's an Aesop story. But in the Aesop story, the bird is slightly different. Like in this one, it's a sparrow and an eagle. And I think in the Aesop one, it's a sparrow and a crow.
I don't know that story. I'll go ahead and announce. I get to choose next, and I think I want to do Aesop. So we'll see that if that story is an Aesop's fable, we'll see it when we get to it.
Yeah, but do you know, like, I know nothing, and so it's like, oh, I'll just ask Michael when I get on the podcast with him. Like, is Aesop older? Is Aesop newer? Like newer than Arabian?
Well, again, it's hard to tell because the stories from the Arabian Nights come from so many different places at so many different times that I don't know that anybody can accurately source any of them. But Aesop is older than Islam.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know.
Yeah, he's
probably something I should know, but I was like, I'll just go ahead and be ignorant.
He's third century, I think, but I can't remember if he's third century BC or third century AD.
Okay,
but I do want that to be our next. That's going to be my next pick. So I'm sure we'll get deep into Aesop early next year.
Excellent. That sounds like fun.
Well, shall we get started with the they're not all animal fables, beast fables, but most of them are something approaching beast fables.
Yeah, most of them are. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's start with the peahen, the duck, and the gazelle. So there's an island on which a peahen runs across this very frightened duck, and the duck tells her that she's afraid of human beings because she has had this dream where the son of Adam, which is what they call human beings, appears to her, and a voice warns her about him. And so after this dream, she goes walking, and she runs into a series of animals who are all afraid of Adam, or the son of Adam, excuse me. She runs into a lion cub, and she asks the lion cub to kill the man. And then they run into a donkey, and the donkey says, human beings are going to ride me. They're going to treat me without dignity. And then they run into a horse, who's actively running away from the son of Adam, and the lion cub makes fun of him because he says, you know, you're so big and magnificent, what are you afraid of? And the horse says, well, the son of Adam is much smarter than any of us, and he's going to trick me into working until I'm too old to work, and at that point they're going to kill me and skin me. And then they run into a camel, and the camel tells them that the son of Adam has put a ring into his nose and let children lead him around. And then the camel quotes a poem that's going to come up in a later story too. There's some weird parallels between these stories, but the poem is, when an oppressor settles in a land, all that its people can do is leave. So finally the son of Adam arrives, and he's a carpenter. And he tells the lion cub, actually, I'm not the son of Adam. I'm also running away from the son of Adam because he hurt me as well. And the carpenter tells the lion cub, look, I'm going to your father's house. Your father's vizier is the lynx, and I'm going to build a house for the lynx. Well, this makes the lion cub very jealous. And so he demands that the carpenter make a house for him too. And so the carpenter builds him this box that is a cage for the lion cub. And the duck sees all this, flies away, and tells the story to the peahen. While the two of them are talking on this island, a gazelle shows up, the gazelle from the title of the story, who plays a very minor role. And the three of them take vows of friendship, at which point a ship arrives on the island, and the three of them scatter. The peahen goes up into a tree and flies away. The gazelle runs away as fast as she can, but the duck is too frightened and confused to move, and so the human beings catch her. She says, caution has not helped me against my destined fate. And the peahen is very sad because the duck was her friend, but the peahen says that the reason that the duck was taken was that she didn't praise God enough. And that is the story of the peahen, the duck, and the gazelle.
Yeah, you mentioned in your introduction that there's not a lot of Islam in these, but there is in all of these opening ones. There is a formula of praise.
That's right.
That the animals use, and the gazelle learns from this that to praise God more, and so goes around saying, "Glory be to the Judge, the Omnipotent, and the Ruler."
That's right. Yeah. So, like I said, it's not that there's no religion in it. There's just nothing that strikes me as exclusively Muslim. A lot of the stories are very, very Muslim. Even as people do a lot of stuff that good Muslims aren't supposed to do. The background of the stories is Islamic. I don't see that as much in most of these. There's a couple where I see a little bit more of it, but these feel very much like they're coming from some other culture than the Arabian culture.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like this, you know, like the lesson is like to praise God more.
Which comes out of nowhere, right?
Yeah, it really does. It really comes like right out of nowhere. And it's like, okay. So yeah, like, because as you said, in a Kipling, you would expect, like, oh, and so, and this is the reason why ducks do this, or this is the reason why gazelles do this. But no, none of that is in there.
Right. It has more of the feeling of an Aesop's fable, right? Where now Aesop, from my understanding, doesn't include the moral. The moral is added later. But the Aesop's fables are there to teach a lesson. They're almost parables. This one is too, except what's weird is the moral comes from inside the story, and thus you can kind of doubt it, right? It's a really weird reading from the peahen. There's been nothing in the story up to this point that would suggest that the duck is not sufficiently pious, or that piety is an important thing, or that God even exists. But all of a sudden, the peahen at the end has this very, very tidy moral. And the only reason that I'm not inclined to think that we're supposed to laugh at the peahen for that moral is that Scheherazade herself is going to give that moral in a later story. That same moral.
Yeah, I don't know. But it is weird because it feels very tacked on, like it doesn't seem like I'm just not quite sure where it came from,
Right. Yeah, there's just nothing that would seem to suggest it. And there are stories in the Arabian Nights where that is fairly clearly what the story is trying to say, but this one, I wonder if what happened, and we'll never know, but I wonder if what happened is the author of these tales, the compiler of these tales, I should say, knew this one and felt that it was not sufficiently religious and tossed that on there. Because there's no reason for it. If the story had just ended with the duck being taken and the peahen grieving it, the story would not feel incomplete, no more incomplete than some of these other ones do. A lot of them kind of cut off very quickly, and you're like, what was that?
What just happened?
But I mean,
But this
that
doesn't.
was true of a lot of the Grimm's too, right? The endings are
That
kind
is
of
true.
unsatisfying.
Very true.
I liked this story a lot, and I was interested in the human being's role in this, that the human being is the bad guy.
Because it's told very much from the, like, I mean, not the human being is not just the bad guy. The human is like this, like, terror, like, it's like, I mean, it's Bambi, like, man is in the forest. Like, it's that level of, like, terror,
Right, except in Bambi, the reason man is terrifying is he has this tool that kills the animals very easily. But this guy doesn't have that. All he has is his wits. And so I think a lot of the animal fables in this section have a message about power and about how to use it. And that's why the king is so interested in them, right? This is, I think, the only place where we have seen, except at the very end of the last section, this is the only place where we've seen the king interrupt Scheherazade and say, "Oh, I need to listen to this."
I noticed that also. Like, the king shows up here for the first time. Like you said, at the end of the last section, he says, "Can you tell me a story about a bird?" Which is just kind of funny, but now he's actually a participant, which, to this point, we haven't seen him since pre night one,
But it makes sense that all these stories about how to use your power would appeal to a king. And I guess the issue here is that, and this is an old idea, that human beings don't have physical strength, not compared to like a lion, not even compared to a horse, maybe not even compared to a donkey. But what we have is our wits, and so you can outsmart these other animals, and in doing so, you exercise your power over them. So man is exercising his dominion, which is what's going on in the Kipling stories for sure. Anytime man shows up, it's always to exert his power over the other animals.
Well, and that's exactly, I mean, yeah. The lion, I mean, as you mentioned, like, he cannot believe that this horse would be afraid of a man, or that the camel would be afraid of a man. And then, when the man shows up, he doesn't know it's the son of Adam, But he's like, whatever kind of creature you are, like, I can tell that you're not built for keeping up with us, wild beasts. And he knocks him down at one point,
Yeah, he exerts his physical power over him. And it says the man is really mad about it, but he holds his anger inside. So the
Yeah,
man
but he's like,
is, yeah, the man is able to do that in a way that, maybe the other animals aren't.
yeah.
It's an interesting story.
It's very interesting. It was really fun. And of course, yeah, like in the building of the house that the lion demands, that he built this house and he ends up building just this tiny cage and, tricks the lion into getting inside of it, even though it's too small, and then shuts the door and that's it, So.
Well, and then, of course, a lion's not made to live in a house anyway. So the lion is wanting something more than nature is willing to give him. He should be living in a cave somewhere, I guess. I think lions
Oh,
just sleep on
yeah.
top of rocks. I don't think they actually live in caves.
Yeah, that's a good
And
point.
well, that and that's another thing that comes up throughout these stories is greed. A lot of these animals are going to run into trouble because they want more than they're supposed to have.
That's absolutely right. But that doesn't seem to be the case for the duck. The duck just, I'm not quite sure, like, what the duck was a little confusing to me because she's given this vision, she's given a dream, and then she's rightly terrified of the man and what the man will do, and she tries to avoid it, but it's there's something in this one about like not being able to avoid fate
Right, there's
or
two different
something.
morals to the story. The duck has one interpretation and the peahen has another. Well, the next one is the one that isn't really about animals. There's some animals in it, but it's called the
Well, there's
pious.
the pigeons first. The pigeon one is like a sentence long, There's a hermit, he shares his mountain with some pigeons, and he blesses them and says, multiply, and then he, shares half of his food with them, and so the pigeons multiply and multiply on this mountain until he dies, and then they scatter. And so that was what I was joking about earlier. Like maybe the message is this is why there's pigeons in every city or something, because they multiplied on this mountain until the hermit died. But
So you're
yeah.
treating that as a separate story.
Well, I think so. I think it is. I think it's meant to be because then it shifts to the shepherd after that.
Yeah,
I don't think the shepherd
certainly the hermit
is.
and the shepherd stories have nothing in common except that they're pious and live on the mountain. But our edition doesn't treat that as a separate story. I mean, our edition's not God. There's been a couple times where it seems to me there's another nested story that our edition doesn't recognize.
Well, I felt like it was because again we get the formula of praise, and the pigeons is
That's
glory
true.
be to the author of all creation, the distributor of sustenance, the builder of the heavens, and the unfolder of the lands,
And
which is quite
it
nice.
makes an interesting contrast to the last story, right? Because the hermit is good to the animals. He's not exercising his power over them.
And he's blessing them.
Right. And it's implied to be part of his piety.
Yeah. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's
You
fine.
can tell.
I like the idea that that's a separate story. It certainly makes more sense of it if it is, because if it's part of the same story, it makes no sense at all. Okay, well, on another mountainside, there's this pious shepherd who lives this quiet, safe life among the beasts because of his piety. So we see there again that this shepherd is at one with nature instead of dominating it. But God wants to test the shepherd, and so he sends an angel in the form of a beautiful woman, and the shepherd is utterly disgusted by this woman. But she promises if he'll sleep with her, he'll get all manner of things. But he tells her that a person can either desire her or he can desire the next world, and he's chosen the next world. And so the angel sees that the shepherd is faithful, and he returns to heaven. Well, next to the mountain, there's a village where a second or third pious man lives, depending on whether you think the hermit is part of the story or not. And this man has a dream telling him, there's a shepherd up on the mountain, you need to go be his disciple. And as he goes up the mountain, all these birds fly off because they're frightened of him, and the man is disgusted with himself, and he's afraid he's going to be punished in the afterlife because these animals are afraid of him. But he keeps climbing. Eventually, he meets the shepherd, and the two of them are friends who worship God together for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, having no concern for any worldly thing.
Right. Yeah, that otherworldliness that the shepherd has already appealed to, right? That he doesn't need this woman because he's not concerned with this life.
Yeah.
But it's like God doesn't want him to be alone, and so he sends him the pious man.
Right. Yeah, it's not good for man to be alone.
Right. But. Yeah, the friendship kind of takes place.
A very weird twist. Well, yeah, and I don't know. I was listening to a different podcast the other day, and they were talking about the ancient world and the role of women in it, and how they were, you know, this is in like Roman culture, and you know, like the women were so low, like lowly regarded, that it was like you couldn't even love as a man, you couldn't even love a woman. Because it'd be like loving a different kind, you know, like true love only happened between men and men, you know? And
yeah, women were just there because men can't procreate with each other.
Right. Exactly. So I don't know if that was true across the board in ancient cultures. Like, I don't know if this is saying something about that, you know, or along those lines or not, you know, but that was because I just listened to that last night. I was like, oh, that's interesting. You know, it kind of resonates a little bit, you know, he rejects the woman's friendship, but then the other aesthetics relationship is fine.
So right. Right. Although the woman's not exactly offering friendship, right? She's trying to seduce him. And it made me think,
that's true.
It made me think of the story of Saint Anthony in the desert. Do you know the story?
I do not know.
So this is an early Christian monastic, and he sells everything he has because he hears the gospel that tells you to sell everything you have. And he goes off in the desert to be pious, and the devil appears to him in the shape of a beautiful woman trying to seduce him. Except here, it's not the devil. It's an angel sent by God to test him, which is interesting.
Right. Yeah, that is interesting.
And I wonder if it is responding directly to the story of Saint Anthony, because I mean, you know, that would have been a very well-known story, the first big blockbuster text of the Christian era is Saint sure. Athanasius's Life of Saint Anthony. So So I wonder if whoever first wrote this story was aware of it and was kind of drawing on that story.
Yeah. Yeah, like, do you feel like in like a critiquing way, like it's a response in a critiquing way, or do you feel like it's a garbling of it, like yeah, you know, it's a telephone version of it?
Yeah, it feels like just a garbling of it. It's the same story, but it's like it's coming from a different place, and the reward is different because Saint Anthony lives alone in the desert mostly for the rest of his life, and this man, I guess, in reward for resisting. The temptation is not alone. He has this friend.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Now all I can think of is the hermit in the cabin in the Bride of Frankenstein, which I suspect is not drawing on this. Actually, let me put my cards on the table and say that I'm actually not thinking of the hermit in the Bride of Frankenstein. I'm thinking of the hermit in Young Frankenstein. Have you seen that movie?
I'm not sure if I have. I may have. I think I've seen, like, years ago, I was watching some of those, but I couldn't differentiate them in my mind.
Yeah.
So. Maybe this fall, Halloween time, maybe I'll watch Bride of Frankenstein and Young Frankenstein.
Bride of Frankenstein is actually a pretty good movie. I think it's better than the original.
Yeah. Are those all Universal Monster movies?
Yeah, although Young Frankenstein is the Mel Brooks parody.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's got Gene Hackman as this as the hermit. I remember it being a pretty close parody too. I think he's smoking marijuana. I don't know.
Yeah. It all comes out of that same cauldron of soup though, somewhere.
Yeah, I mean it does, right? There's this idea of the hermit who is alone for religious reasons but still lonely. Although we don't get any sense that the hermit on the mountainside is lonely. Right? Like there's nothing that would suggest that he is aware that he needs another person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we don't get any interior from him really at all.
Right. Or really anybody else.
Yeah. You get a little here and there, but not in these, not in this story for sure.
But it's like the Bible, right? I mean, the stories in the book of Genesis, none of them have really any interiority. The ancients,
right,
and even the medievals to some extent aren't really interested in psychological realism.
Yeah. Yeah. It's left for us to figure out, I guess.
Are you ready for the next one?
Well, right after this one is when our king comes back into the story, King Shahryar, and he says, "You have made me renounce my preoccupation with my kingdom, and you have made me regret the excesses to which I went in killing women and girls." Which I think is a pretty, like, I mean, it's definitely related, right? Like, because this guy renounced the beautiful woman, and then you know, this story must have struck to the king's heart, which is, I mean, it's pretty wild, because like you said, he has not shown up at all until he said, "Do you have any stories about birds?" And then this was in the line of the story of birds, you know.
Yeah. Especially if you think that the hermit story with the pigeons is still part of it. But what's interesting to me is he says that, which you would think would be the end of the entire collection. Right.
But
instead, it's going to go on for, what, 800 more nights?
Yeah. Well, that was the part that was like amazing to me. It's like, well, what happens now? Like, what is this? You know?
But she continues as before. But then she doesn't trust them. And a lot of these stories are about not trusting repentance.
That's true. Yeah. And he does follow that up with, "Do you have any more stories about birds?"
The man loves birds. I can
Although. Write. Yeah. Although I will say that a little later, I don't think I wrote it down after which story it is, but there's one point where it actually comes to an end and she says, "I'll tell you another story tomorrow if you'll allow me." And so usually she cuts him off, you know, in the middle of the night so that he has to keep her alive to hear the rest of the story. But there is, after this moment, there is a moment where she says, I'll tell you more tomorrow if you'll allow it. So maybe there was a little bit of, you know, a test of trust there. Potentially.
Yeah, that's interesting. The next one is called The Waterfowl and the Tortoise. So a waterfowl comes across a human corpse and she concocts this this story about what has happened, you know, that he has betrayed other people and so they've killed him. But then a bunch of vultures come to eat the body and the waterfowl has to leave. Oh, it's a him, not a her. The waterfowl has to leave his home and he runs into this tortoise. And the tortoise says, "Why are you running away from home?" And the waterfowl tells him that same verse we heard earlier. It's actually a little bit different, but it's very similar. "When an oppressor settles in a land, all that the people there can do is leave." And so the tortoise says, "Look, I'll stay with you. I'll take care of you. And you need to stop being so anxious because anxiety is going to ruin your life." So finally, the waterfowl flies back home and he sees that all the vultures and the other birds have left because they finished eating the corpse. They weren't interested in staying in this swamp or whatever, wherever the waterfowl is living. And so the waterfowl returns to the tortoise and says, "Why don't you come back with me so that we can be friends, but I can still live in my home?" But then on the way back, a hawk kills the waterfowl. And here's where it's very explicit that the reason the waterfowl gets killed is that he's not pious enough. And that is the dissatisfying end to the story of the waterfowl and the tortoise.
Yeah. This was really shocking. I really liked this one up to the end. Like, I felt like there was some this one felt like a collection of proverbs that like got a story written around it, you know?
Yeah.
Which is fine, you know, like that's an interesting kind of genre, I guess, the proverb as story genre. But like the tortoise has some really good wisdom, you know, and says, like, you know, people of intelligence, it's, you know, the best consolation for people of intelligence is for them to make friends in their exile and to show patience in the face of misfortune and distress. I hope that you will approve of me as a companion, for I will be your servant and your helper. And so there's like this, you know, the solution to the problem is, you know, befriending the tortoise. And then they do become friends, but it's doesn't last long.
Well, but, and for all the tortoise's wisdom, he doesn't tell him the thing that would apparently have saved his life.
Yeah.
He has this purely ethical wisdom with no religious component to it. When what the waterfowl needed, and again, here, it's coming from the story itself. You can't say, well, the peahen is just making this up to try to create some justice in the world. No, I mean, this is the canonical reason why the waterfowl dies, is he doesn't praise God enough.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in the fact the waterfowl suffers misfortune and feels sorry for himself, but he assumes that the misfortune that the man has suffered is a retribution for his sins. That's interesting,
yeah.
Right? The waterfowl assumes that somebody else is just getting what he deserves, but that he is not getting what he deserves.
Right. And then the thing that he was supposed to be saying goes right along with that, because it's glory be to our Lord in what he decrees and contrives. Glory be to our Lord who enriches and impoverishes. So, like, it's the Lord who's doing it, right? Who brings fortune or who brings poverty.
The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
Yeah, and you're supposed to give glory either way, right? And in this case, you're right. Like, the waterfowl is ascribing the reason for people's poverty not to God, but to, you know, the man's wickedness, or, you know, the wickedness of these other oppressor creatures that are dragging him from the land, you know.
I wonder, have you noticed that the two waterfowl are the ones who've been killed so far?
That's true. Something very impious about waterfowl.
I wonder how common waterfowl are in the Muslim world. You know, a lot of that land is desert.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that question. Right. I don't know how much
a great question
they would have had with waterfowl.
Hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Pious creatures.
Well, we have a long one next. Are you ready?
I'm ready. This is the one that is very similar to a Grimm's. I don't know if you remember that Grimm's.
I don't remember.
So there was a wolf, and the Grimm's version, I'll give it in the two-sentence version, but there's a wolf and a fox, and the wolf is always, bullying the fox around. And so the fox acts like he's going to take the wolf into a place where he can get food, and he takes him into the basement of a merchant or a butcher or baker or something. I forget which basement he gets into.
But he gets him in, and the wolf has to starve himself to get out.
Yeah, but he can't. Or, well, maybe there's more than one. Because I thought that in the way I was remembering it, the you know, whatever shop that he's gotten into has found him and you know, kills the wolf in the basement. But maybe you're right. Or maybe there's more than one. I don't know.
There's probably more than one.
And go back and listen to our Grimm's episodes and let us know.
And I mean, because of the nature of all of these stories, they could be coming from some sort of previous story, the same one, or Grimm's could be drawing on this somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, the world is smaller even in the Middle Ages than it appeared to be.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
So there's a fox and a wolf, and they live together, but they're not friends, because the wolf lords his power over the fox and abuses him. And the fox warns him, God is going to punish you by sending the son of Adam after you. But ultimately, the fox just can't do anything, and he's so afraid of the wolf that he figures the best way to deal with him is to constantly flatter him and just wait for his chance to bring him down a notch. And he gets that chance when he comes across a vineyard with a gap in the wall, and both the fox and the wolf want to go eat the grapes. The fox can understand eating grapes. Do wolves eat grapes?
Yeah, they love them.
Obviously.
They're big fans of grapes.
Grapes are poisonous to dogs. I wonder if they're poisonous to wolves too, and foxes for that matter.
Hmm.
Well, anyway, the fox understands that the reason there's a gap in the wall is that human beings have set a trap to catch animal intruders. And it's one of those traps where there's a sheet over a big pit. So the fox isn't fooled by this, because foxes are clever. But he goes and tells the wolf that the vineyard is wide open for him to go in and eat all the grapes he wants. And so the wolf rushes in and he falls into that pit. And while he's down there, he's feeling sorry for himself and weeping for the condition he finds himself in. The fox comes by and tells him, hey, this is your own fault for being so greedy and also for being so cruel to me for so long. Well, the wolf begs him for forgiveness, and he begs the fox to help him get out of the pit. And he appeals to their friendship, but the fox says, "We've never been friends." And he tells him a story that we'll talk about in just a minute called The Hawk and the Partridge. And this story demonstrates that the wolf deserves everything that's happening to him. Nevertheless, the wolf continues to appeal to the fox's pity. He continues to call him his friend. The fox calls him an idiot, tells him, we're not friends because you have constantly betrayed me. And so the wolf falls into despair and cries some more. And he announces that if God will just rescue him from the pit, he'll repent of his sins and he will treat people who are weaker than him with compassion. And finally, the fox feels sorry for him and dangles his tail into the pit so that the wolf can climb out. At which point the wolf pulls him down into the pit with him out of pure spite. So the wolf is going to kill the fox, but the fox tells him, hey, look, the two of us can actually get out of this if we work together. And the wolf is worried that the fox is going to betray him, but the fox says, look, I'm not going to do that because if I did, I'd be punished by God or by karma or whatever. And the wolf doesn't really believe him, but nevertheless, he boosts the fox up on his shoulders and the fox climbs out of the pit and starts making fun of the wolf again. And once again, the wolf appeals to their friendship. And once again, the fox tells him a story in response. This is the story of the man and the snake, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But that story demonstrates the fox just cannot trust this wolf. And so the fox goes off and leaves the wolf to die in the pit. And after the wolf dies, the fox comes by and looks at his body, and then he lives in the vineyard happily eating grapes for the rest of his life.
Yeah, so the thing that's amazing to me is, so the heart of the story is exactly the same as Grimm's, but this story is so Arabian in my very, I mean, everybody knows how ignorant I am of everything, but like, you know, from reading the Arabian Nights so far, like they love Proverbs, they love poetry, they love long dialogues in which the characters quote proverbs and poetry at each other. And this like tale is just full to the brim with it. They sit at that pit, the fox talking to the wolf and them quoting poetry and proverbs at each other for an extremely long time.
Right, so I cut it way down.
I was sure that what was going to happen was the humans were going to show up and catch them both being there because they were babbling at each other for so long. That's where I thought the story was going. They talk for a very long time quoting. And I mean, you mentioned like there's a couple stories that are told, a couple nested tales. And so it's like really fascinating to me that like the bones of the story are exactly the same as Grimm's. But the German efficient way to tell it versus the let's stretch this out for you know, let's have a meal together and several courses, you know.
And I think that is what keeps me from really loving the Arabian Nights is just that everything seems longer than it needs to be.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I don't live in the Middle Ages, which means I have a lot of books that I could read. I don't want each one of them to take a long time.
That's right.
I don't mean to be flippant, but I mean that's just the truth, right? Is mm-hmm. They didn't have as many options as us, and so probably they had a better attention span for what options they did have.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of great lines in this one, though, you know, about not acting unjustly when you have power or doing good right away when you have the power to do it, because you might not have the power to do it later. And yeah, there's a lot of it was fun. It was a fun little story. And the you know, when the fox gets pulled into the hole, I was like, oh no, like what an idiot. How did he do that? But then he talks his way out. He foxes his way right out of it, you know. And so it was great. I liked this one a lot.
I was very interested in the wolf's repentance and the idea that the fox gets into trouble because he believes that the wolf repents, and the fox gets into trouble because he has compassion. That compassion is not an ultimate virtue. It needs to be used prudently. And the fox is not prudent in that moment. He is for most of the rest of the story. This is just a momentary lapse in his cleverness and his prudence.
Yeah. Yeah, when he hears them say that, if God frees me from my distress, I shall repent of my haughty behavior towards those who are weaker than me. I shall wear wool and go up onto a mountain, reciting the name of Almighty God in fear of his punishment. I shall keep away from all other beasts and bring food for the poor and for fighters in the holy war.
Good. Of course, for the wolf to wear wool. That suggests something totally different. That's an Aesop, right? The wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah, it must be. But like, this is. I thought that too. I was like, oh, there might be a strong temptation for the wolf to go back on his word if he's dressed in wool up on the mountain. You know.
Also, they're obligate carnivores. He's gonna have to. He's gonna have to eat somebody. He's gonna have to be cruel to some animal or another. He can't just eat grapes the rest of his life.
You might be able to in this story, but
yeah, I wonder if they're wearing clothes. I never considered that, but if he's saying he's going to wear wool, maybe these are animals who are dressed in human clothes, except there's human beings in it. Usually you don't see that at the same time.
That's true. Yeah, it's rare that you see the humans in clothes and the animals in clothes. That's true.
Well, let's look at the two stories that the fox tells the wolf to demonstrate why you shouldn't help him. And they're very short, and they pretty much have the same. Well, no, I guess they don't. The hawk and the partridge. One day a hawk captures a partridge. The partridge gets away from him. And the hawk follows him and tells him, look, I wasn't trying to eat you. I was a stupid bird. I was trying to help you get some food. And the partridge, like a moron, believes him and comes back. And then the hawk does eat him. And the partridge curses him. And after the hawk eats him, he loses his feathers and dies.
Yeah.
So I guess the partridge in the story is the fox, and the hawk in the story is the wolf. And the fox is foolish to believe the wolf, although he does, after the story, believe the wolf. And the wolf is going to get his for mistreating the fox.
Yeah. Yeah. It is funny, though. I hope that when you eat me, I'm poison to you, and it turns out that way.
That's all he's got. I like the idea that the hawk has gripped the partridge in his talons. I believe that is the language the story uses. And the partridge believes him when he says, I was just trying to help you get some food.
Yeah. Come on. This is how I always help my friends.
The other story is the man and the snake. A man comes across a snake who's running away from the snake charmer, and he tells the man that if you help me escape, I'll reward you. And the man helps him escape, and the snake gives him the only reward that snakes give, which is to say he bites him and kills him. And that is a very straightforward story.
Yeah, it kind of flips the first story we were hearing, though. You know, like in this case, the man is the one that gets fooled by the animal.
That's true. It reminds me of the toad and the frog and the scorpion. Do you know that one?
You'll have to remind me. The frog, I may know it, but
the
I don't
frog
know
and the scorpion are running away from something. I assume a man, but maybe a larger animal. And they come to a river. And of course, scorpions can't swim, but frogs can. So the scorpion asks the frog to take him on his back. And the frog says, I'm not going to do that. You're just going to sting me and I'm going to die. And the scorpion says, hey, look, if I sting you while you're swimming across the river with me on your back, I'm going to die too. So it's totally against my self-interest to swim to sting you. And the frog says, yeah, okay. And so he takes him across and the scorpion stings him. And the frog says, hey, you're going to drown now. And the scorpion says, hey, I'm a scorpion. So it's a pretty similar story, except the snake doesn't get punished for killing the man, but it's like, this is the only thing I can do. What do you expect?
This is who I am.
I'm a snake.
All Cretans are liars or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I don't know if that's an Aesop or it's not a Grimm's, because I would remember that.
Yeah, Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess we'll find out in the coming month.
Next, we have the weasel and the mouse. So a mouse and a weasel live together in a farmer's house. And the farmer gets sick one day, and the doctor prescribes him sesame seeds. I was just reading about this yesterday, that in the Middle Ages, the medicine is so primitive that like 60-70% of the of the prescriptions were just change your diet.
Yeah.
I don't know what sesame seeds are going to do, but that's what the doctor prescribes. And the farmer's wife ends up preparing the sesame seeds by soaking them and then by husking them. And then she leaves them out to dry, which seems like a remarkably stupid thing to do. But I guess they don't have Tupperware at this time. So the weasel spends all day going in and taking seeds away until almost all of them are gone. And the farmer's wife comes back and is shocked and wants to know where they are, who took them, so that she can punish that animal. Well, the weasel at this point realizes she has screwed up royally and she wants to atone for her sins. So she starts bringing the seeds back. And when the woman sees her doing this, she realizes, oh, the weasel isn't the one who stole the seeds. Instead, the weasel has found the animal that did steal the seeds and is returning them to me. What a nice thing for it to do. And so she decides to set a trap to find the real culprit. The weasel goes to the mouse and tells her, look, there's a bunch of sesame seeds out there. All the other animals have taken some. It's your turn. Why don't you go have some? And the mouse rushes out, and when the farmer's wife sees her, she beats her to death with a cudgel. Beats the mouse's brains out, I believe is the way.
I didn't care for this story.
It doesn't seem fair, does it?
No. It's like... I mean, the weasel didn't have to do that. The weasel was done. I mean, the weasel was free, you know?
It does seem kind of a gratuitous action from the weasel. But, I mean, yeah. I don't know much about the role of weasels in Islamic culture, but, I mean, maybe this is a scorpion issue where this is what weasels do, and the mouse
maybe
trust the weasel.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it is true that it's not like the mouse is innocent. The mouse is stealing sesame seeds. So in a certain sense, the mouse gets what she deserves, and the weasel doesn't get what she deserves because she's weaseled out of it.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, the moral of the story as given is that this mouse was too greedy. But the story the weasel tells her is that the farmer and the wife were done with it. Like, it's leftovers, and all the other animals have gone and had it, you know, like, so, I mean, yeah, I get it. She's being... You know, she's taking something that's not hers, but she's a mouse, you know. I just know.
Never trust a weasel, man.
I guess never trust a weasel. Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever seen a weasel.
But that didn't seem to be the moral of the story.
No, it doesn't.
Don't trust a weasel.
It's you know? Specifically about greed. You're right.
Yeah. So.
But the weasel seems to. I guess the weasel is not as greedy because the weasel returns the seeds. But you're right that it.
Yeah.
Greed does not seem to be the thing that motivates the mouse, and it does seem to be the thing that motivates the weasel.
Yeah.
Also, it's hard to call an animal greedy, but I get it. We're dealing with beast fables, so you got to think of them as people, or like half people.
Yeah.
But I mean, what's the mouse supposed to eat if she's not stealing food from people? It's not like she can grow her own grain.
Yeah. Not until the rats and them, anyway.
That's right. I never read that.
What? Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, Michael, that is one of my like all-time favorites.
I should read it.
Yeah. Yeah, you should, and let me know how you like it. But it's really good.
Next up, we have the crow and the cat, one of my favorite animals and one of your favorite animals.
It's true. But before you tell this, we have to acknowledge that this is in a very specific genre now that has been asked for. Do you have any tales, Michael, about the beauty of friendship and how its preservation in difficult circumstances has led to a rescue from death?
Well, you can see how, why he would want that story after the weasel and the mouse, because those animals are supposedly friends, and look how the weasel treats her.
Yeah, that's right. Tell me one where friendship rescues us from death instead of leading to death.
As the great Pauly Shore says, don't tease the weasel. All right, so here's a story about friendship. The crow and the cat, they live together as brothers. One day a panther shows up, and the crow flies away, but the cat can't. And so he begs the crow to save him. Well, near the tree where the crow's gone up, there's a hunter with dogs. And so the crow goes and slaps one of the dogs in the face and flies off. And so the dogs follow him and chase off the panther. And the cat is saved. You know, that's a thing. Crows actually, they don't slap animals in the face, but they'll go up behind a wolf and pull their tail.
So my daughter told me, because my daughter is very interested in crows, and she told me that this was an almost symbiotic relationship that forms between wolves and crows,
yeah.
Where crows will play with young puppies. They'll pull their tails and they'll develop a friendship with the wolf. And then the wolf will protect the crow, but also the crow can fly and find, you know, things and lead the dogs to panthers, you know.
Well, and then the crow will swoop down and eat some of the meat that the wolf has killed. And in fact,
right.
I read that some zoologists believe that the reason wolves evolved to hunt in packs is the only way they would have enough to keep the crows away.
Oh, interesting.
But it's also flatly true that crows make friends with people and I assume other animals and bring them gifts and stuff. And yeah. There are stories of pet crows that are friends with cats.
Yeah. So.
But this was a nice story, right? I mean, it's very straightforward. There's almost nothing to say about it, but
yeah,
it isn't. Unlike so many of these other ones, it is two animals living in peace together.
That's right. You just need to be specific about what you want in your request, and then you get it.
I really love the image of the crow going and slapping the dog. Yeah. And then the crow pretends to be hurt so that the hunter
he's like flying low and like flopping around in the dirt and stuff.
But yeah, also, what's so the hunter going to do if he catches a crow? You can't eat them.
Right. Well, it's the dogs. The dogs chase the crow.
Yeah, and the dog might eat. I guess the dog might eat a crow. I don't know.
Yeah.
I wonder how many crows get caught by dogs, though. Crows are so much smarter than dogs.
They're very intelligent animals.
Being able to fly really helps. Well, here's another crow story.
Another very smart crow.
Yeah, that's true. The fox and the crow. So there's a very famous Aesop story that's the fox and the crow. That's the one where the crow is eating a piece of cheese and the fox flatters the crow to drop the cheese and then he eats it.
Mm-hmm.
This is not that story. So the fox lives on the mountain. He's so hungry that anytime his wife, I guess, has a baby, he has to eat it, even though he feels awful about it. Well, he sees a crow and the fox hopes that the two of them can be friends and that the crow will help him find food, just like apparently happens with ravens and wolves. And so the fox appeals to brotherhood, and here he appeals to Islam. This is, I think, the only explicit reference to Islam in the animal stories. But the crow is suspicious because the fox is a predator. Crow is a prey animal. How can they be friends? And so the fox tells the crow the story of the flea and the mouse, which we'll talk about in a second. It doesn't convince the crow. The crow tells the fox a very short story called The Falcons and the Birds of Prey. And that story demonstrates that the fox makes up for his lack of power by cleverness and trickery. And then the crow tells him the story of the sparrow and the eagle and warns him not to try to be more powerful than he is, lest destruction come upon him. And so the crow refuses to be friends with the fox and refuses to help him find food.
Yeah, I got to say, I was a little confused on this one. I mean, I thought the story was cute. I saw how the Falcon and the Birds of Prey story played in, as well as how the flea and the mouse, that one made sense to me, but then it lost me a little bit with this, you know, the sparrow and the eagle, which is another, that's the one that I was telling my kids were saying was an Aesop. But
why don't we go through those three stories and come back to the fox and the crow then, and we can kind of figure out how they fit together.
Yeah, let's do that.
So the flea and the mouse, this is another friendship story. A mouse lives in a rich man's house. A flea goes and sucks the man's blood while he's asleep, and that wakes the man up, and he tries to find the flea, but the flea runs away and takes shelter with the mouse. And the mouse is surprised because the flea should be afraid of the mouse. But the flea tells him, look, let's be friends, and I will reward you for your friendship. And so after that, every night the flea goes and sucks the man's blood, but he's not greedy about it. He takes just enough to stay alive. Well, one night the man brings home a bunch of dinars, coins, and he spends much of the night turning them over and looking at them from every angle. And the sound of the coins clinking wakes the mouse up, and he sees the man put the coins beneath his pillow. And so the mouse hatches a plan for him. For him and the flea to take the coins. But the flea points out, we're not really strong enough to do that. And if you try to do something beyond your power, that's going to get you into trouble. The flea's not able to lift a coin, but the mouse can. And if the mouse is able to do that, he should go ahead and take them for himself, and the flea will help him. This is his reward. So the flea goes and bites the man again and again until he can't sleep in the bed anymore, and he leaves. But he's forgotten all about the dinars, and the mouse goes and steals the dinars.
Right. So, so a weird thing about this story is the mouse is very firm in the beginning with the flea about living a life of contentment. And the flea responds, if God grants me prosperity, well and good. And if not, I am content with what he gives. And after that, he does. That's when he starts drinking only as much blood as he needs, because prior to this, he was waking the man up, and the man and his whole house was searching for this flea, and that's why the flea ran away to the mouse's, right? But then when the money comes into the picture, the mouse throws all that out the window.
Right. And what is the mouse supposed to do with the money? Is he going to go to the that doesn't make sense to me.
I'm not quite sure what the mouse wants the money for. But then, I mean, it all works out. It works out in the mouse's favor.
Well,
you know?
I'll point out the whole thing only happens because the man is greedy. If the man hadn't stayed up closely examining his money all night, the mouse would never have even been aware that they were under the pillow.
Mm.
Okay. So maybe man is being punished for his greed.
Yeah, I guess so. But either way, it makes sense the fox is telling this story, right? It makes sense in the way that the fox is telling the story, because the fox is saying, look, these two creatures that normally you would not expect to get along, and they cannot, you know, they wouldn't help each other, but they did. They ended up helping each other, and the mouse was rewarded for it. And so, crow, why don't we do the same thing? You know, like this, it worked for the flea and the mouse. Why can't it work for us? So that one makes sense to me in the context of the fox and the crow tale.
Okay. And so here's the story, the first story that the crow tells the fox, the falcons and the birds of prey. It's one of the shortest stories in the whole collection. The falcon is a tyrant over the other birds of prey, but as he gets older, he loses his power, and the only way he can get food is by tricking the other birds. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, the point here, I guess, is that the fox is trying to trick the crow because he doesn't have the power to just grab him and eat him.
Yeah. Which, that also makes sense to me in the sense of the story.
It's certainly an understandable reaction from the crow, but I'll point out there's nothing in the story that should lead you to believe that that's what the fox wants. The fox is very open with himself about his motivations. He's hoping the crow will help him find food. He does not want to eat the crow.
Yeah, but if you're a crow.
Right. Totally understandable.
He says, God has given me strength in my wings, caution in my soul, and clear sight. So he has caution in his soul, as all crows should, I guess.
Next, we have the sparrow and the eagle. So this is the crow telling the fox the story. There's a sparrow, and he watches this eagle swoop down and carry off a sheep. And the sparrow starts to think, well, maybe I should do the same thing. And he picks the biggest sheep in the flock, which is a ram. He's a sparrow. He weighs 3 ounces. And when he swoops down to the ram, his feet get tangled in the wool, and he's stuck. And so the shepherd comes over, yanks out his wing feathers, and gives them to his children to play with. And the moral is, again, very explicit. You should not punch above your weight. You should recognize what your power is actually like and live within the confines of that power.
Yeah. When he tells that story of the sparrow, can't you just picture Arthur as when he's turned into a sparrow?
Oh, yeah. From the stone.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the one that, like, I mean, the story makes sense. The moral makes sense. But in the context of what's happening between the fox and the crow, I don't understand why the crow is accusing the fox of punching above his weight. I mean, it seems like the fox is actually saying, like, hey, I need help.
Right. Right, I don't.
So that's the part I didn't quite understand. I didn't understand how this quite fit in.
Even from the crow's perspective, I mean, is the point that the fox is less powerful than the crow, and if the fox tries something, the crow is going to beat him to death? It's just hard to see that, especially since the crow has already said, "I'm prey and you're a predator."
Yeah. So. And I mean, I guess it kind of relates a little bit back to the flea, because the flea does say something very similar, right? When the mouse wants to take the coins.
That's right.
About not going above, you know, not punching up. But then it works out for the mouse. So I don't know. I was a little baffled by this whole thing. And then the fox says, "I see that you're a greater cheat than I am." And he runs off. I didn't quite get that either. I was like, how did the crow cheat you?
Maybe the fox really was trying to trick the crow and eat him. But it almost seems like the first half of the story was written by one person and the second half was written by another. They just pasted two fox and crow stories together.
Yeah, this one didn't quite hold together for me. And maybe I'm missing something, or maybe there's something cultural or, you know, contextual or something, you know, but I just, this one, each individual story was fine, but I didn't quite see how they hung together. So
I really liked the sparrow and the eagle. I thought that was a very funny story.
Yeah, I liked that story a lot, which is why I told it to my children. And then they're like, it's not an eagle. I think they said it was a crow or a raven in the Aesop, but I guess we'll find out when we get to the Aesop.
A raven tried to swoop down and take a sheep? Or it must be another animal.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I should have.
I think eagles do come down and take sheep.
Yeah, eagle made sense to me. I was kind of like, what? With my kids, but they were adamant. So I don't know. Anyway.
Well, the next one features an evil hedgehog, an animal that you almost never see in an animal fable being mean.
Yeah.
But a hedgehog
that surprised me too. I was like, what? The hedgehog is mean?
Well, I mean, but his enemy is the dove.
Yeah.
So this hedgehog lives next to a date palm that has a pair of doves living in it. And the hedgehog is jealous because the dove and his mate live this really easy lifestyle. They just sit up there and eat the dates off the tree. And of course, hedgehogs can't get up the palm tree to get to the fruit, so he decides to trick the doves. He builds a chapel of prayer and he pretends to be an ascetic, and the dove comes down because he feels kind of sorry for him, and the hedgehog tells him, "I've been an ascetic for 30 years," which you think the dove would have noticed that the hedgehog has lived next to this tree for a while and has not lived like that, but nobody ever said these doves are smart. So the dove is really deeply attracted to this lifestyle. He wants to be an ascetic too. And he asks him how he can detach himself from his worldly cares. And the hedgehog says, "Look, the best thing you can do is knock down all of the dates from this tree. I'll hold on to them for you. And you can come to me and I'll kind of divvy them out to you when you really need them so that you're not too greedy." Well, the dove does that and the hedgehog takes the fruit. And then when the doves come down and ask him for some of the fruit, he kills them and eats them. And as he does so, the dove warns him that God is going to take revenge on people who perpetrate injustice, and tells him the story of the merchant and the two thieves, which we'll get to in just a minute. But this story ends here, basically, that the hedgehog eats the dove. We never see, unless I'm terribly mistaken, we never see anything bad happen to the hedgehog.
Yeah. The dove says, "Don't you know the victims of injustice have a helper?" That's a great line. But then, yeah, we don't see comeuppance for the hedgehog.
Do hedgehogs eat meat? I thought, well, they eat insects. I think they're insectivores.
Yeah, I don't know much about hedgehogs.
It's just insane to think of a hedgehog eating a dove. Like, there's something very upsetting about that.
Yeah, especially a hedgehog who's dressed up as like a cute little friar.
Builds a chapel of prayer.
He builds a chapel. That seems like a lot to go through for a trick, you know? I'm going to build a chapel.
Also, if you think about it,
speak in Proverbs.
You've got a goose that laid the golden egg situation here, right? Which is, he could rely on the doves to continue to knock the fruit down.
And oh, yeah.
Have enough to eat for the rest of his life.
That's right.
He kills the dove, and how's he going to get the fruit now?
Yeah, this is a great way to live a world. You're right. His answer could have been to release yourself of worldly cares. donate some of what you would normally eat for yourself to people like me who are living on the ground, you know, for every one that you eat, knock one down, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, we're back to greed, except here the greed, it will supposedly be punished in the future, but we never actually see it punished.
Yeah. You have to trust. Trust in that. So.
Don't trust repentance and don't trust piety.
Yeah. Quite a lesson.
All right. Well, here's the story that the dove tells him. It's the merchant and the two thieves. Two thieves follow a wealthy merchant, pretending to be merchants themselves, and their plan is to rob the man, maybe kill him, but each of them plans on betraying the other, and ultimately they just can't wait to betray the other until after they've already gotten the money from the merchant. So each of them poisons the other, and when the merchant comes across their bodies, he realizes what's happened. And that's the story of the merchant and the two thieves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what the dove says to the hedgehog is don't be like these things.
Yeah, because you're gonna get punished by God. Although what's interesting, I mean, God does not really intervene in here. They kill each other. It's they're right. Punished by their own evil rather than by
evil cannot maintain, you know, relationships and friendships and things like that. Like all the good things in life, all the generative things in life. Cannot be. I mean, and that actually makes sense of why the hedgehog could not just befriend the dove in some ways. You know, if the hedgehog is truly evil, then you know it just evil just doesn't have space in its world for that. it's too much of a world of scarcity.
Right. Yeah. Well, we've got more thieves. This is the thief with the monkey. Although the monkey plays a very small role in this. There's a thief who travels with a monkey and he comes across somebody selling used clothes. And so he gets the monkey to distract the man and he steals the clothes. And then he goes to another market and he sells the clothes at this very low price on the condition that the pack they're in not be opened until later. I don't understand that part, man. I don't know if they opened it, if people would recognize that these were stolen clothes or what, but a man is.
Well, it's kind of like, where you got to go bid on the closed storage things. You
can't see what's
inside until after you bid, you know? So I think the idea is, you know, this is really low price and it's a great deal that it's a low price, but like, I'm not haggling here, you know, like just take the low price and go type thing.
Well, a man buys the clothes at the low price and he plans on selling them at a profit himself, but his wife realizes he's been cheated. I don't really understand how he's been cheated, but that's the way she sees it. And she castigates him for not examining what he was buying before he buys it. So she tells him the story of the foolish weaver, which we'll get to in a second, but he is not impressed by that. And he continues to buy stolen goods at a cheap price until he gets in trouble with the authorities and dies. It says he perishes. I don't know if they have him put to death for being a thief, which he's not. He's just buying stolen goods and then reselling them. But the implication, right, is he knows they're stolen.
Yeah. Yeah. He fell under suspicion and perished. So. Fill in the blanks yourself.
So this is another story warning you against greed.
Yeah. Not much to say about it.
Yeah, me neither.
except yeah, it's good. It's good not to be greedy. I mean, it's working on King Shar on the king, you know, because he says, "You've drawn my attention to everything that I have been neglecting. So give me more of these examples." So it's working.
He's a simple man. He enjoys these stories with a clear moral much more than he enjoys the shaggy dog stories.
Right. I guess so.
Next, we have the foolish weaver, which is the story the wife tells the husband. So there's a weaver. This one's pretty funny. There's a weaver.
This one is really funny. I like this one.
There's this weaver who has to work very hard for his living. And a rich man throws a big party and he invites everybody in the village. Which is something, at least in Christian Europe, rich people were expected to do. The lords were supposed to throw a big Christmas party, and all of the vassals and peasants were supposed to be able to come into the Great Hall. So I assume it also happened in the Islamic world. So the weaver is really impressed by this party, and he wants to change his profession so he can be rich and well-respected. And instead of becoming a merchant or something, he sees acrobats at the party, And he says, that's my path to riches. And so he climbs a wall and throws himself off of it, only to fall and die.
He breaks his neck.
Yeah. So don't try to be an acrobat if you don't know how to be an acrobat. And again, you've got the greed motif and the don't punch above your weight motif. You're not capable of doing this. Stop trying to do it. And I guess what the wife is trying to say is, you're not really capable of being a thief. You're not smart enough to do it. So don't try to do it.
Right. Yeah. But he doesn't listen to her, you know.
Right. Well, and that's how he perishes.
Yeah, that's how he perishes.
All right. One more. This is, and then we can talk about the long one, although I have much less to say about the long one. I didn't even take notes on it. The sparrow and the peacock. So there's a group of birds, and they want a king who will adjudicate among them. They have a social contract here. And so the sparrow recommends his friend, the peacock. And the peacock becomes the king of the birds. And he treats all of them justly. And he makes the sparrow his vizier. Well, one day the sparrow is late for work. And the peacock is really worried about him. And when he shows up, he says, why are you late? And the sparrow says, well, a man spread a net out near my nest. And that I watched, and he watched two cranes get caught in this nest. And so the peacock says, look, don't try to go back there. You're not going to be cautious enough in order to save yourself. Just stay here at the palace, which the sparrow does for a long time, eating very rich foods. But eventually he sees two other sparrows fighting, and he decides his job is to adjudicate between these two sparrows. And when he tries, the hunter sees this big fat sparrow, and he catches all three of them in a net. And so the sparrow should have listened to his friend the peacock.
Yeah. Caution does not help against the blows of fate.
Again, a strange moral, right? It seems more like you should have been more cautious. You should have right. You should have recognized that my job is to figure out who's right in these bird disputes, not yours. But that's not the explicit moral. Caution's not enough.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, because I didn't catch that. Yeah, you're right. The king peacock's job is to adjudicate, not the sparrow's job. Because the sparrow, yeah, he sees them fighting and he's like, "Well, I'm the vizier. Can I allow these two sparrows to be fighting?" But you're right. Yeah, he should have let the peacock adjudicate and not tried to intervene. So I missed that. Good point.
Poor sparrows. They don't come.
Poor
in.
Sparrows.
Well, they are very small birds.
It's true. They are. Low on the totem pole of the birds.
I wonder if they were eating them or if they were keeping them as pets, because the shepherd gives the sparrow to his kids to play with.
That's true.
But I mean, people did eat songbirds. It just doesn't seem like a sparrow would give you very much to eat.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I don't know.
All right, well, our long story, which I did not like and don't have a whole lot to say about, is Ali ibn Bakir and Shams al-Nakir. I think,
yeah.
I'm sure I'm pronouncing those wrong. So I'm going to let you summarize that one.
All right. I'm just going to call them Ali and Shams.
That's fine, yeah.
I'm sure I'm pronouncing them wrong too. But our first character is actually another guy named Abul Hassan. And he's a merchant. And one day, this beautiful girl comes into a shop while Ali is there. Ali is a Persian princeling, we're told. And so Ali and Abul are hanging out in the shop. Beautiful girl comes in, and Ali actually gets up to go. He's like, I can't be here. And it connects to what we've been talking about, because he's like, you're too beautiful for me. I know I'm not going to get up to your level, and you're not going to come down to mine. But this, she says, actually, you know, stay. And then she asks about him and says, I'll send for you later. And so sends for him later, and they go to the palace, because it turns out that this girl, Shams, is one of the favorites of the caliph. She's one of his concubines and one of his favorites.
And this is our old friend, Rashad, right? The Rashid, the caliph.
Right, Harun al-Rashid. So obviously this is a love that cannot be. And that's going to be the main point of the story is that they are in love with each other, but this is a love that cannot be. Ali says, you should have warned me where we were going. Abul says he was afraid if he told him, then that his passion would prevent him from coming. But actually, that would have been better for everyone if they had not come. But anyway, there is a lot of singing, and the love songs invoke a lot of tears and weeping, moaning, complaining. Fires of compassion, of passion are, you know, just lit within Ali and Shams. Every time there is music in this, they are consumed by a violence of love and desire, and they embrace each other and they faint. All like every time, like there's just a lot of fainting. So Abul Hasan is shocked at this behavior. He's like, if you're like this when you're together, what's going to happen when you're apart? Which is a great question and is going to pay off very well. So anyway, they're eating, they're drinking. They are just in so much pleasure. But then knock on the door, one of the slaves comes in and says, hey, the eunuchs are here and they're looking for you, Shams. And so Shams hides the guys and she goes out and meets the eunuchs, and the caliph wants to come and see her. And so she says, you know, give me a few minutes to get ready. And so she goes out to the garden and they're hiding on the balcony, and they are seeing Shams interact with the caliph, and of course there's music playing, and when the music plays, they're both so passionately in love with each other they can't stand it, and they both faint. And so the caliph is very worried about Shams, and meanwhile the slave girl who helped them hide comes up and finds the men who are hiding and says, you got to get out of here. And Abul is like, Ali is passed out on the floor, how are we going to get out of here? But somehow or another they get out, they sneak out through the back door of the palace, and you know, back doors of palaces always lead down to rivers, and they get on a boat and they cross, you know, the river, and they're safe, and it's good. Thanks be to God that we have escaped from this peril. So Abul now is going to spend a lot of time going back and forth from being in his shop and worried about his friend Ali, and going to visiting Ali. And Ali is he's a complete mess. He's a disaster. He can't even get out of bed because he is so passionately in love with this, you know, with this unrequited love. And the slave girl comes and visits him in his shop and tells him that Shams is feeling the same way, that like she's a mess and he's a mess, and they're both a mess. There's some letters that are passed back and forth between them. There's a lot of more weeping, there's a lot more fainting. It's a very gloomy situation. Abul is just, he doesn't know what to do about them. He says to them, or he says to his friend Ali, I've never seen or heard of a lover like you. And then Abul kind of seems to be like, so like, I don't understand what is happening with you. I need to get out. I need to get myself out of this story, is basically what it seems to happen. So he has a friend who's a jeweler, and he tells this friend like, hey, I've kind of got myself in the middle of this situation, and I'm worried that if it comes to light that there is this illicit affair happening, that I'm going to take the fall for it because I'm the one who connected them. And so I'm going to pack up my stuff and I'm going to leave and I'm going to get out of the story. And his friend, the jeweler, is like, that seems like a good idea. So Abul leaves and he goes to Basra and he leaves the story. And that's the last that we know of Abul. We don't know anything else about him. So meanwhile, the jeweler goes to visit Abul one day, not realizing that he's already left. And his friends and neighbors say, oh yeah, he left to Basar. And there's a girl there. And it's the slave girl who is hoping, like she's been using Abul as an in-between to transfer these notes back and forth, these letters. And so this jeweler steps in and takes the place. And now he is becoming the in-between between the palace and Shams and Ali, both of whom are bedridden in their because every time they hear music, they faint because of their passionate love for each other. And so the jeweler decides the only way that we can like work this out is we've got to actually get these two together. So he's got a secret home. He has his number one home, and then he also has this second home, which is a secret home. So he sets up his secret home, and it's going to be this rendezvous place for them, and he's going to have them meet each other there. So he arranges this all with the slave girl, and they come and of course, the day that they are meeting, there are these thieves that have recognized that the jeweler has been getting this place all prepared and bringing in all this nice stuff. And so they attack to plunder the house, and everybody scatters, and nobody knows where anybody else went to. So the jeweler runs into a neighbor's house, the slave girl and a couple maids, they get up on the roof and they escape their way, and Shams and Ali are actually captured by the thieves. Well, now the jeweler is really in a panic because he's like, oh no, this affair is definitely going to get out now. And so he's weeping and mourning and not sure what he's going to do when a mysterious man shows up at his door. And this mysterious man says, follow me to your secret house. And he's like, oh, you know, I have the secret house. And he says, just follow me and God will take away all of your cares. And so the jeweler has nothing else to do, so he follows this mysterious man. And this mysterious man takes him through parts of the city that he's never seen before, and across a river, and to a house. And he takes him into the house and locks the door behind him. And there are 10 men there that look identical, because they're all actually this, like, brotherhood of thieves. And they say, do you know who we are? And he says, no. And he says, do you know who I am? Like, yes, we know who you are. We robbed your house and we kidnapped these two people who were inside it. And we thought that they were just like a peasant and a singer. But then as we have examined them, we realized that they had some sort of nobility about them. And so will you reveal who they are to us? And so he does. He tells them their secret. And they say, okay, we didn't realize, you know, who we're robbing from. We've already gotten rid of some of your stuff, but we'll give you back the stuff that we have, and we will release your friends, and we'll release you. So they take them back, you know, they give kind of like an honor guard, 5 of these matching men on each side, and they take them to the boat, and they go across the boat. But then as soon as they get out of the boat on the other side, these riders swoop in upon them on horses. And they're like, where are you guys going and who are you? And the jeweler tries to tell a tale, but he's kind of stumbling over his words. And then Shams, the girl, she goes to the captain and she whispers something to him. And at that, he dismounts and he lets her ride the horse, and he takes them to another place where they can get on another boat, takes them back to the palace, or takes her back to the palace, and takes Ali and the jeweler back to Ali's house. So everybody's wondering what has happened. Ali's whole household is like, what has happened to Ali? But the jeweler won't tell them anything. He is sure that he is in major trouble. Like, he has spilled the beans on the story. It's gonna get out. The writers caught them. Like, there's just no way that all this stuff is not gonna come to light. So he's hiding out in his house, but finally one day he dares to go outside, and who would be out there but the slave girl who's been waiting for him? Well, he tries to run away from her. He's so scared of her, but she says, no, I like, everything's okay. When I escaped from your house, when it got, you know, attacked by the robbers, I went back to the palace and we were hiding, and we hid everything. And, I went and checked the gate in the back of the palace, and lo and behold, you know, Shams was just arriving at that moment. So everything is good, you know? And, all the story comes out. They all share all their story and what happened and everything. And, everybody's happy. And in fact, she has sent some money from Shams for him. So he's goes and he repairs his house after it being plundered. He's able to repurchase the things that he has lost. He goes and tells Ali everything's okay. Ali says, great. But Ali, remember, is a Persian princeling. So he has extra goods and stuff. And he repays him as well for helping them to get together. And so the jeweler now is like feeling like, okay, I'm in a good spot. I've got all this stuff. But he goes back to his house, and before he even sits down, the slave girl returns and says, the worst has happened. The maid has spilled the beans, and the caliph knows, and he has taken Shams, and she is under the guard of 20 eunuchs. So he panics. He runs out of there. He goes over to Ali. He says, Ali, if you want to save your life, we have to leave town now. They get like 3 camels worth of stuff. They run out into the desert in the cover of night, dresses in disguises. They go as far and as fast as they can, and then they are so exhausted that they don't even worry about their safety, and they go to sleep for the night. Well, because they weren't worried about their safety, they're attacked by another band of robbers, and this band of robbers takes everything and leaves them naked. So they crawl into town naked and into a mosque. They are found in a mosque by a benevolent old man who gives them clothes and takes them home. But shortly after that, Ali, who has been fainting 99 times in this, now says, "This is my final faint. You know, I'm definitely going to die. Tell my mother to come and, you know, bury me and wash my body and stuff." And he hears a song, and it's just too much for him. It's, you know, it's a song of unrequited love, and it's too much for him. And his soul leaves his body and he dies. So the jeweler goes back to Ali's house, tells the mother. She faints also. So it's a little like mother, like son, I guess. But anyway, she's going to go take care of Ali. Then he goes back to his own house. He's thinking about Ali and how handsome he is and who should appear but the slave girl one more time. And he sees her, and she's in great distress. And she says the caliph loved her so much that he would not hear anything bad about her. So it didn't matter that the maid spilled the beans. But even though he loved her so much and didn't kill her for her infidelity, or wouldn't even believe that there was any infidelity, she heard a love song and it was just too much. And her soul left her body. And so she died, and the caliph freed all of her slaves. So now we are living by her grave. And tell me about Ali. And he says, Ali has also died. And she said, when's the funeral? And so they meet up together at the funeral, and they both mourn for Ali and Shams. And the jeweler continues to this day to go and visit their graves every day, mourning over this love that was not meant to be.
I found this story so tedious.
It was, if you found my telling tedious, it was 20 times more tedious in the actual story.
That's right.
Because I left out a lot of poetry and a lot of fainting. There's a lot of fainting and a lot of poetry.
We do see something here we've seen in several others, which is that love is just this incredibly destructive force that leads you to despair. We've never seen it quite this seriously, but that is a recurring theme in the Arabian Nights, is that people just can't handle love.
Yeah, it's too powerful, and it especially when it is a love that, you know, we saw it with last month with the jerk guy and his cousin that he was supposed
Aziz
to
meet, and Aziza,
right? Aziz and Aziza, and Aziza dies in this same way. Like, she is so passionately in love with her cousin, and he's totally blowing her off, and so it's that same sort of unrequited love. And it kills her, you know? And so here again, we see love killing people. I feel like this would be a very dangerous story for Shahrazad to be telling, because if we remember way back when we started the Arabian Nights, like the whole thing is the king does not want any infidelity among his wives and concubines, you know? And so to tell a story of a unfaithful, I mean, there's never any, like, their love is never consummated in any sort of physical way, but her heart is obviously with Ali. And I feel like that's a dangerous story to tell. But so maybe that too is a sign of something is changing in the relationship here.
That's a good point.
But yeah, it's a little bit Romeo and Juliet.
I was going to say that, you know? It has that. Although they actually kill themselves instead of just being overwhelmed by the impossibility of their love.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a sign of a different cultures and different, like, more like a desire in the audience for something a little more real. You know, like a knife can kill, but I don't know about, like, being so brokenhearted that hearing a... I mean, these musicians must be incredible and also very dangerous.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, it's really dangerous to be going around singing a a broken-hearted song, because you just don't know how many people with broken hearts nearby might just faint or die from hearing this song.
If this story had been 5 nights instead of 16 nights, I might have enjoyed it. And maybe we were just spoiled by having so many short ones in a row, but this one just kept going. And there really wasn't much new as it kept going.
No,
I don't normally make this complaint that things are too long, but oof.
the pace on it was definitely weird, because there was like a long period where they're just exchanging letters and they're both just like, madly in love with each other and whatever, and then there was like, in a very short time, it's like they're attacked by robbers and then they're fleeing for their lives and then they're attacked by robbers again. Like it was like boom, 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 boom. And it was a very strangely paced story, that is for sure. Also, that I just like, there was a really weird moment in this story that when they switch from our initial friend, Abul, whatever, Hassan, into the jeweler. And, I don't know. Did you notice this? Like the handoff of the account was really weird, because it says, according to Abul Hassan's account, this is a really weird line. He had a friend. Like it was like, it's almost like Abul Hassan has told the story. Like this is how she knows the story, is like she got it like later from Abul Hassan or something, because then it switches to the jeweler. And then after that, the jeweler starts selling it in first person, like I did this and I did that. It was just very, like, a literary standpoint is like just very strange, I thought.
Yeah,
Very
it's like
strange story.
a semi-nested story.
But not quite.
Not
Like it
quite,
was
'cause
like
it's the
a,
same story.
yeah. So it was, I don't know, it's weird. I don't have anything to say about that, except I noticed it and I thought, wow, that's a really strange handoff that happened. But I felt a lot for Abul Hassan. I was like, I feel you. Like you're like, I don't understand what's happening. I'm just gonna get out of this story.
Yeah, I wouldn't have minded getting out of the story myself. Going off to Basra.
I feel like there's, yeah, I feel like he's the character you identify with.
Think
Yeah,
this has probably been my least favorite of the stories, except some of the barber stories from way back.
oh man, that barber was annoying. That barber was so annoying.
But those were
Listen,
all
I get it.
short. I mean, it was like one was stacked on another, stacked on another, stacked on another, but oof.
I didn't hate this one, and I mean, I didn't love it either, but like it was definitely tedious. But I felt like it was effective in the sense of I was concerned about these characters. Like I was wondering what's going to happen to them. Is the caliph going to find out and have them all killed? Are they going to get away with it? Are they going to, is she somehow going to escape the palace? Like I was curious. Like it kept me involved. Especially once like more and more and more people started finding out about the secret. Like it really, like, because at the point of the robbery, the jeweler who's supposed to be keeping their secret, like that's his one role in all of this, is to, and what he's promised to both of them is he's covering all this up. But when he runs away and is like hiding out at his neighbor's house, his neighbor comes in and is like, "What are you doing in my house?" And he's like, "Oh, robbers attacked my house. I was hiding the concubine and her illicit lover in my house." Like, I mean, he just tells the neighbor. I was like, "Wow, this is going to turn south really quick, And then he tells the 10 robbers, of course. Like, I mean, not like, yeah, like that seems like a dangerous thing to tell, 10 thieves. So.
And you also wonder if the caliph might approve of the relationship. We've seen that before. These kings kind of handing the concubine off to a man who loves them.
Right, yeah. So that could have happened, but it didn't. So, but it kept me involved enough to see, like, oh, what's going to happen?
Hey, you know what I read about Al Rashid? I didn't know this. There was a real Jafar. There was an actual vizier for Al Rashid named Jafar. And Al Rashid had him and his whole family hanged. So all of those references to Al Rashid joking that he's going to have Jafar and his family hanged, that is a thing that actually happened.
Wow. Oh, that's dark.
Well, we have another 80 night 140 page story for next month, but we're going to do the whole thing. I haven't started reading it, so I don't know anything about the story of King Shahriman and his son Kamar al-Zaman, but I assume we'll know all about it after 140 pages of it for next month.
For sure. That'll be great.
And then I think we only have two episodes left, maybe one. I don't know how we're going to divide it up. It'll be 150 pages after that.
Yeah. I have a text from you about it, so but we'll figure it out.
Oh, there's so many stories in this. And then I want to remind you, we're only, even after we finish this, we're only going to be a third of the way through.
That's right. But we're going to take a break.
Yeah.
We're going to go do it. We're going to do Aesop.
Something probably, with shorter stories.
Yeah. Aesops are very short. So we'll have to figure out how to even tell those.
We'll be back to the Grimm's version where we pick some, don't do them all.
Yeah.
Which we maybe should have done in this episode, given how long we've gone.
We have gone longer than normal, but it's been fun. Yeah. And it's been a good time. So, all right. Well, our press liaison is Kristen Filipic, and we're on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. And you can help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. You can also check out Michael's weekly podcast, A Symposium of Popular Songs, which is available at Front Porch Republic.
And by the time this airs, we'll be back. We'll have new episodes again. I took the month of July off, but 3 days before this episode goes up, a new episode of Symposium went up.
There we go. Great. We also want to encourage you to set your podcast player dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, where you'll find an abundance of old shows and some occasional new shows. I think there was a new Christian Humanist Profiles just this week or last week. So
I haven't listened to it. It said Ian Hunter, and I wondered if Gilmore was interviewing the lead singer of Mott the Hoople.
It could be. I also have not listened to it.
Oh, man, I would love to hear Nathan interviewing Mott the Hoople.
Nathan is a good interviewer. I enjoy listening to his interviews.
Better than I was back when I used to.
You were fine. I think you were doing a great job, and I appreciate that. This show ended up taking a lot of your time, but there were things that you were doing prior to this show that were also very good.
The truth is about this show and about Symposium, Josh, is that neither one of them takes that much time, and that's why I could continue doing them. Whereas a weekly show or a show where I had to read a bunch of academic books, I don't get to read for a living anymore, so I don't have time to do it.
Right. Well, I'm glad that we're doing this. So anyway, we know there are a great number of podcasts out there you could be spending your time on. So thank you for spending your time with us. For Michael Farmer, I'm Josh Altman-Schofer, stretching out one weak hand to say goodbye with the other placed above my burning heart. May this not be the last time that we meet, and may this not be the last of my journey food. There we go.
How do I stop the recording?
I don't know. This was a fun one, I think.
Yeah. Hang on a second. Where is the button to stop it? Because you have to stop the recording. You can't just leave the meeting or it won't save the recording.
Right.
I feel like usually there's a button. But we just did an hour and 40 minutes, and I don't want to accidentally not record it.
No, don't lose it. Do you hit the red square at the top?
When I do that, it changes it. A thing pops up, and there's a button, record audio and video. Mm. And if I do that, I can apply changes, and I'm afraid that that is not actually a way to stop it. Let me see if I can figure this out. I wonder if they've changed.
Yeah. I don't get the controls on my side, so since you're the host, I don't have any of them.
So in the recording, click on the More Options button again and select Stop Recording. I mean, I know it's recording. That button does not appear. All it says is record. And when I click it, it gives me that same toggle button, record audio and video. Oh my gosh.
I'm just afraid we're going to lose the whole thing. I just think that is what I'm going to have to do, is hit that and see what happens. Do I have your permission?
Yeah, that sounds fine.